That white privilege should be human privilege. Not that white privilege needs to be destroyed, but that everyone, all persons, need to enjoy the rights that we associated with white privilege.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Owls at Dawn. We are just two dudes from Southern California who studied philosophy, politics, and religion around the world. We decided to start a podcast where we could bullshit with impunity. I am Austin Hayden Schmidt.
And I'm Troy Polidori.
And we've got a guest this week. But before we go into our guest, which I'm really excited about, we're going to start off the episode the way we start off every motherfucking episode. The shitty minute. Troy, what is grinding your gears?
Yeah, no serious guests and discussion until we go and just, like, pound some shitty minute out. So my shitty minute this week is probably the most important shitty minute I've ever done.
Whoa.
Ever.
Whoa.
This will be ground-shaking, earth-shattering, Gettier paper-esque important.
Okay.
And that it is absolutely 100% incontrovertibly not true that college basketball is better than professional basketball.
Oh my gosh.
Because you're going to hear this truism all during March Madness, during the NCAA tournaments. The college basketball is better, and I don't watch those professional basketball players because they're all tatted up and they're all, wait, they don't get that racist on, like, usually. But because they do it only for the money and they're flashy and they don't play team basketball and they're just a bunch of individual superstars, yada, yada, yada. Therefore, I watch college basketball because it's pure, unadulterated. It's the actual team game. It's Gene Hackman's Hoosiers. That's false. If someone says that, slap them in the face. Actually, literally slap them in the face. They deserve it. What they've just said is the most inane pack of bullshit anyone will ever say about basketball, the beautiful sport that is. So you should slap them. Look, I'm going to keep it quick, short and sweet, because this is just easy stuff. College basketball is frenetic. It's chaotic because the guys aren't good at basketball. It looks like they're playing harder because they're like a bunch of five-year-olds running around kicking the ball down the floor. Five-year-olds trade ends when they're playing basketball a lot more than professional players do because they have no fucking idea what they're doing. College basketball is just slightly more organized than that. That's why it looks like they're playing harder. They're not playing harder. They're playing dumber. That's what's happening. They don't care more either. Also, that just goes to the idea that if someone looks like they're playing more frenetically and chaotically, that they must be trying harder. No, trying harder does not mean actually performing better or at your optimal capacity. It just means you're wasting energy. Also, I have a strong incentive to think that when people say play harder, they actually mean play whiter, like whiter. There's a definite bias people have where if they see a white guard play, they're going to use an adjective to describe him, like gritty.
He's a hustler.
And yeah, a hustler. Whereas when black players do it, it's just expected. And when they don't do it, then it's because they're entitled and lazy. And then when a white player doesn't do it, it's just ignored.
They're just relying on their athleticism, right?
Yeah. Of course they can die for the ball because they can jump a lot higher. And the white guy does it, he's actually trying harder. There's a strong confirmation bias going on there. But even if you don't want to go down that more kind of racial road, pro basketball is so much better than college basketball. I mean, even down to the actual aesthetics of it, its skills are so much more refined and utilized.
Their bodies are so much more cut. Their haircuts are so much better.
There's so much more fun, that's for sure. The next time I have to see some, like, 6-foot, short-armed, buzz-cut, military-looking motherfucker, you know, get 3 assists in a game and be like, oh my God, he's going to be the next great god of basketball. The
Jimmer
Tim
Fredette?
Tebow of college basketball. Well, Jimmer Fredette was actually played very NBA style. He was a gunner.
Yeah.
But no one called him that because you don't call white guys gunners.
I will say this, though. So what do you think about the whole school spirit thing? Do you just think that's bullshit?
I mean, whatever. If you want to do that, go for it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
If you like college basketball, I watch the tournament and I enjoy it. But I enjoy it somewhat ironically because it's shitty basketball. And because there's a manufactured scarcity with the one and done system, which is great.
Right. It's love exciting. It
for that reason. But I don't care that if people say that. I get upset when people say it's better than professional basketball.
What about
I
the
only
idea
watch college that, basketball.
What about the idea, though, that it's more of a team game? Because it is. You don't have the superstars. It isn't much about as much about someone like a LeBron or someone like a Kevin Durant who's just going to clear out and, you know, pick and rolls, one-on-ones, clear outs. That shit gets boring to me. People don't play defense. Now, that's changed. Some teams do. The Golden State Warriors obviously play great defense. That's one of the reasons that they, you know, made it to the finals the last few years. And if you look at the teams that are consistently good, it is, I mean, the Detroit Pistons, you know, in the early 2000s, they were a great defensive team. So the Boston Celtics in the 80s were a great defensive team. But that's the exception. That those are the top two or three teams, and then the other, you know, 28, 29 teams.
Totally disagree with kinda, everything you just said.
You do. Totally I don't disagree. Know about that. Dude. And I think the reason is because you were right that there isn't as much talent at the college level, so it's much more about a band of brothers. And so you've got to play team defense, and you've got to play a motion offense. You've got to play a team offense where you pass the ball, you're running on screens, you're constantly moving. You have to do that because you actually have to try to free up individuals that don't have the individual athletic skill to take a man to the hole by himself, one-on-one.
Yeah, don't agree whatsoever. And statistically, I think you can prove it. There are more passes per possession in the NBA than there are in college, even though college has 6 extra seconds on the shot clock to deal with. We think of the NBA as being more superstar-driven, because there are superstars who are the greatest players on earth, but there's more team ball played in the NBA than college. College, the ball sticks a lot. There's more isolation plays because guys aren't good enough to figure out how to play team ball properly. The NBA is at a point where there's more team ball than there's ever been because of different rule changes, which we don't need to get into right now.
Real quick, the statistics that you say, though, are kind of, they seem unfair because college basketball has like 600 teams. So you're talking about a pool that's highly diluted. So it's hard to compare them to a smaller sort of fraternity of 30 or so teams, right?
So you're going to have
the shitty D1 team that only has the one player, and so they're going to isolate. But if you're talking about the teams in the tourney, the top 25 teams, that college basketball consistently, to me, is much more of a team sport, and it's much more evenly spread out. Now, you might be right that once you go down to like Southeast Florida or whatever the fuck the school is. And even if they're D1, they only have one or two players. And so there is going to be much more isolation. But I mean, if you take the top 25, it just doesn't seem as concentrated that there is that isolationist play. Now, I'm biased. I'm totally biased. I will say this outright. I love college basketball. And I have been one of those people that has parroted that college basketball is better than professional basketball. So for me, I feel like you are attacking my sensibility.
Absolutely am.
But I'm just trying to think through it because I wonder if that's the case. But I will say the Golden State Warriors, I really fucking love watching them. I've really enjoyed watching them over the last couple of years. I really enjoyed watching OKC the last few years, you know. So, but I haven't been paying as much attention to basketball over the last 5 years than I have, you know, in my previous 25 years of my life. So
I would just challenge anybody who thinks that way. Actually, look at it. Analyze the two. Look at a bad professional team like the Lakers and a good college team, like, say, Kentucky. The Lakers are going to pass more than Kentucky does on offense, and they're going to rotate more as a team defense on defense than Kentucky does.
Kentucky's a bad example. It's John Calipari. Come on, give us Duke.
But they play pretty good team. Even Duke, who's supposed to be like the paragon of, you know, Hoosier-esque white guys always passing the ball, right?
Right.
They're going to have fewer passes on offense. They're going to have fewer rotations on defense than the pro teams. It really comes down to, I think, for people who watch mainly just the tournaments, it's the manufactured artificial scarcity with the one-and-done system, which is fantastic for drama, but it makes people think more things are happening than are, is my opinion, at least.
All right, two things. First of all, I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to watch the Laker game, the next game, and then I'm going to watch...
Well, don't do that. Don't subject yourself
to
that.
And then I'm going to watch a college basketball game, like a top four team or a top five team. I'm gonna count the passes on average and a half. And then I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to show you my findings and we'll talk about them on this podcast. Deal?
Okay. I mean, that's pretty anecdotal, but.
You just said do it, bro.
Yeah, I did. I did say do anecdotal. But no, I would challenge you to just analyze.
I'm not going
to
do that.
The statements. The team offense and team defense are actually better in college. I don't think that they are whatsoever. And so watch college basketball. Enjoy it for the next few weeks. But enjoy it because it's drama, not because it's good basketball.
I couldn't be more infuriated by a shitty minute that you have given on this podcast than I am right now.
I'm saying it's good. Watch the tournament. It's fun.
Fuck this. Let's go on and talk about some real shit. We have a guest coming up in a minute. Seth Abramson on the other side of the break. All right. Well, cool. Well, now let's transition into our main segment. And I will say I'm actually really excited about this because I sort of Twitter stalked our guest today a couple months ago and told him that we kind of chatted about this structure of feeling or philosophical paradigm that he tends to write a lot about. And I said that he should check it out and listen to it. And I said, one day we'd love to have you as a guest. And we finally got him as a guest. His name is Seth Abramson. He is a journalist, a poet, a philosopher. What don't you do, Seth?
I do as much as I can, but my wife thinks I do too much.
Yeah.
Do you do too much?
Yes. Yeah. No, actually, I do. She's right in that as well as a bunch of other things.
That's how it usually works. So, so today we're going to talk about metamodernism, and we're going to kind of see where the conversation goes from there. But metamodernism, you've talked about it as being described as a structure of feeling or a sort of philosophical paradigm. Can you tell us a little bit more about what metamodernism is and what it's not?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the way I think of it is as both a cultural philosophy, and, you know, I don't think your listeners will have much difficulty understanding what I mean when I say that it's a movement. But cultural philosophy is a little bit of a bigger concept. Essentially, when we call metamodernism a structure of feeling or a system of logic, we're saying that it's a cultural philosophy that allows you to understand what's happening in American culture today, cultural philosophy about why things are happening the way that they are and how politics and business decisions are being made today. You can instrumentalize that philosophy to create new art or to create new commercial products or to create new political sub-movements.
Hmm. So in some ways it's cataloging, if you will, a sort of cultural disposition, something that would you say is a sort of dominant structure of feeling? It's the dominant paradigm or the dominant logical system?
You know, some of your listeners may have heard of modernism, which was the dominant cultural philosophy for the first half of the 20th century. They probably heard of postmodernism, which was the dominant cultural philosophy of the 20th century. And in the case of modernism, it was tied to radio. In the case of postmodernism, it was tied to television. Modernism is really the current dominant cultural philosophy. So it's the dominant cultural philosophy century so far, and it's tied to the internet. And so the basic principles of the philosophy are those which would probably be familiar to internet as their primary medium of communication and self-expression.
Interesting. So who are some of the more, I guess, leading figures within like a metamodernist paradigm? Are guys like Bernard Stiegler, like technologists, would they be metamodernists? I mean, would Gilles Deleuze, is he still kind of on the cusp of post-structuralist metamodern? I mean, who would you see as the kind of linchpin figures?
I would say that he is on the cusp. I mean, as with modernism and postmodernism, not so much a question of major figures, though there are some, Zavarzada, Timotheus Vermeulen, Robin Vandenacker, who are considered major figures in metamodernism. But it's more a function of trends or phenomena that we can associate with metamodernism. So, okay, for instance, if you're familiar with Vaporwave or Chiptune or Folktronica, you know, whether or not we enjoy these particular subgenres of music, those would be examples of metamodern genres of music. So then you'll have major figures within those genres. In terms of the philosophy itself, as a cultural philosophy, that many people yet writing about it. This is an interesting situation where and art and politics has run well ahead of the philosophy. So people are really just starting to put language to phenomena that we've all been seeing for a very long time.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that seems to have struck me is that's why I used the word catalog earlier, because it's sort of like a dictionary. It's not that it's actually trying to push things forward and create something that hasn't been spoken of. It's rather trying to articulate or make sense of a sort of disposition that seems to be prevalent. And it's strange. You wrote something, and because you write a lot about poetry as a poet yourself, you wrote in one of your articles on just the sort of basics of metamodernism, you said that metamodern poems will therefore seem both ironic and sincere, cynical and naive, accurate and false. The poet is laying different emotions on top of one another, giving each their full due in each poem, mainly because they are feeling each of them with equal strength and sincerity. And when I read that, I feel like that's me. That's just like how I think I live life. You know, like Troy,
I'll
do you?
That.
Yeah, right? I mean, does that not, it's so strange when you say that, reading your writing on metamodernism and then just a little bit of secondary stuff that I've done after I came across your work, I kind of, something struck me where I was like, oh, this fits, you know? I feel like the sort of postmodern sarkiness doesn't really fit me. You know, that kind of sarcastic, biting, quick, wittedness that's sort of at a distance from everything. That's just not me. I mean, I think I'm kind of a softy, but because I've become educated under certain rubrics of philosophical education, I feel like I've learned the sarkiness, but it's layered over that sort of sincerity. And so I feel like that sort of meta-modern feeling, that structure of feeling, that it's like, oh yeah, okay. I can get behind this now. So it is interesting that it's sort of cataloging things that I feel like maybe I've sensed or that I've intuited previously.
Is there a sense in which you could say metamodernism is kind of a way of calling the bluff of postmodernism and saying, you know, the cynicism and the irony that is so prevalent in postmodernism just isn't the way anybody actually lives their entire life, and that we have this other dimension that's you know, in contradistinction to that?
Metamodernism came out of postmodernism to the extent that the temperament that postmodernism produced in many of us for deconstruction, for cynicism, for irony, for what we call dialectics, meaning we feel that two arguments have to battle it out until one emerges victorious and the other is completely vanquished. You know, that sort of temperament, that sort of attitude, that sort of way of living became unsatisfactory. The internet had something to do with that. It's kind of everything all at once in one place, yet somehow you have to make it make sense. We can be cynical, we can be ironic, we can deconstruct, but we still have to make breakfast and go to work and have some sense of hope that that things can work out and that there's some meaning. So even though we know that truth is contingent, quote unquote, as postmodernism tells us, we don't strive. Postmodernism positions us, I think.
Okay, so it isn't some sort of return to meta-narrative. It's still, there is still a skepticism or an incredulity to the sort of modern meta-narratives, the reliance on rationalism, skepticism towards religious theological dogmas, things like that. That is still intact, but it's just a sort of, there's an open dispositional hope, and there's a hopeful open disposition towards a field of futures that are not yet discovered.
There's not maybe quite as much skepticism towards meta-narrative as one might think. The better way to say it is there's quite a lot of skepticism towards meta-narrative, saying that we live through the meta-narratives we individually construct anyway.
Right.
Even when we know our meta-narratives are insufficient, they're false, they're fragile, help us. And we can acknowledge that they help us get through the day, they help us get through our lives. And so it's not a return to meta-narratives in a sort of naive way. In fact, one of the phrases often associated with metamodernism is informed naivete. So we are naive enough to believe that metanarratives are valid and are functional, but we are informed enough to recognize, because of postmodernism, all the problems with thinking that there's absolute truth. And one of the philosophers cited in connection to metamodernism is Immanuel Kant, that he talked about living as if something were true,
right,
not true. And metamodernism is very much about living as if certain things like meta-narratives are functional and instrumental, even when you doubt that they are.
It's really interesting. So I'm actually going to mention an historical figure that you probably would not even want to couch into metamodernism. And Troy's going to laugh because this is all I ever talk about. But so my PhD research was on Jean-Paul Sartre, but on the later work from a text that he wrote called Critique of Dialectical Reason. And what I did is I tried to wed certain problems from Critique of Dialectical Reason, which is a profoundly Kantian text. So it's interesting you just mentioned Kant, but it's like Kant and Marx mixed together with some existentialism and starts doing his own thing with Heidegger and some other various things. But and then I take the early work of Sartre's imagination. And he talks about how sometimes you just posit future images to affect yourself in the present, to stimulate you, to motivate you to action. And so what I was really interested in is how do we create society as a work of art by fabricating future images to simply stimulate us in the present to overcome imminent material needs. So if there's some sort of imminent foe that is threatening us, or there's some sort of pressing material scarce issue that needs to be overcome, or scarce resource that needs to be dealt with, then the use of the imagination by sort of imposing these future images is actually quite useful in overcoming those things, even if that future image is just a sort of pragmatic and experimental placeholder. And so that's really where a lot of my work has been done on. And I kind of, that seems to sort of fit into everything you're talking about. It's social constructionism, but not in the way that the critics of social constructionism like to talk about. It's a very sort of hopeful, open-ended constructionism.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, I think you can put it in those terms. I think there are those who have even put it in Hegelian terms, in terms of the triad of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And so the question, can we sort of synthesize modernism and postmodernism, create a negotiation between the two such that we're able to move forward? When Masoud Zabarzadeh first wrote about metamodernism in 1975, dividing postmodernism into three sort of elements. One is anti-modernism, as we have sort of generally understood it. Paramodernism, which was a continuation of the modernist project with all its problematic belief in meta-narrative, enhancement of the individual, though of course at the time it was mostly individuals only of a certain hue and wealth and so on. And then the third sort of subsection of postmodernism that he was identifying was metamodernism, which would be a negotiation between modernism and postmodernism. And so I think if we break down what modernism was as a cultural philosophy, what postmodernism was, modernism is an attempt to move forward in a constructive way with all that we've learned from the preceding two cultural philosophies. I understand that there's a lot of thinking of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, so we really try and go beyond that. But I will say that people will sometimes raise that with respect to metamodernism.
In that vein, one thing I've been wondering when reading your work, Seth, is you know, with postmodernism, you have this incredible, this intense theme of the skepticism of power, and to go along with this talk of meta-narratives. And so much so that sometimes people will criticize of postmodernism the tendency to be so concerned with deconstruction that you give up really any sense of progress or change as a goal, especially in cultural thinking and political thinking. Do you think that metamodernism, because I know you've mentioned that it's about reconstruction as opposed to deconstruction, how do you think that situates metamodernism's, as a cultural philosophy, its intent towards large-scale notions of justice? Is that different than postmodernism, more hopeful?
It is, and I realize we're going to go a little bit into the weeds here, but the man who coined the term metamodernism actually was a neo-Marxist, and the scholars of the 1980s and the 1990s who addressed metamodernism were largely scholars who were members of what we call subaltern communities, communities that had been disadvantaged or underprivileged in academic discourse, and they sort of picked up the torch of metamodernism as a way of critiquing postmodernism and saying that it's possible to deconstruct yourself out of any sense of empowerment. Mm-hmm. And there was a view by Masoud Zabarzadeh and those who came after him, however fragile, however illusory they are, do have the power, who are disempowered, to create a narrative that guides their movement. And so you could almost see metamodernism, darkness of postmodernism, for those who want to develop an instrumental movement that has real effect in the world, but feel that deconstruction doesn't move you forward, it only moves you backward. That's why we talk about optimism, we talk about dialogue rather than dialectics, we talk about reconstruction, not deconstruction, we talk about collaboration with others rather than a sort of lonely individualism, we talk about nostalgia combined with futurism rather than simply nostalgia or simply a focus on the future. All of these are ways to instrumentalize philosophies which had become sort of turgid at the tail end of postmodernism, what we call late postmodernism.
That's the thing that I find really interesting about this whole discussion is, I know you probably agree with me, Austin, this, we've always kind of had this notion that postmodernism has a lot to say about the deconstruction of meta-narratives and you know, capital H histories and stuff like that. And that's all kind of, you can't really deny that that's tenable. At the same time, it just doesn't feel right that that means you end the pursuit of justice.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost, I feel like what you're talking about, it Foucault is popping in my mind right now. His early life, right, is genealogy. It's criticism. It doesn't really seem like he's building up. But then in the later part of his life, he wants to talk about subjects, and he wants to talk about, you know, sort of resisting the powers of a neoliberal hegemonic regime that is going to dehumanize and then build up political subjects that can't experience freedom. And he does that through sexual practice and various other things, you know, the sort of care of the self or concern for the self. It's weird that these figures that are oftentimes characterized as like postmodernist or post-structuralist figures, they seemed maybe in some of their later writings, like maybe even Lyotard.
Derrida as well. With the stuff on ethics.
Derrida too, and exactly. That they started to sort of, maybe they even got fed up a little bit with the sort of lack of substantive options that they could sort of posit, or positive visions that they could work for.
Well, you know, this is one of the reasons why I bring up Hegel and I'm a little bit uncomfortable in doing so, but one of my the sort of additives that I've hoped to bring to metamodernism, because obviously many have written about it, I'm just one person who's written on it. One of the things I've hoped to add to it is the idea that actually postmodernism and metamodernism map onto a sort of triad of cultural philosophies that are recurring philosophies over time, specific exclusively to the early part of the 20th century, then the second half of the 20th century, then the first half of this century. And so sometimes people will say, oh, well, if we can find some metamodern inclinations in philosophers who are considered post-structuralists, does that mean that we're just talking about postmodernism? And I say, you know, no, it means two things. One, we're noting that metamodernism has simply become the dominant cultural philosophy, not that it was previously non-existent, dominant cultural philosophy. And then number two, what I've suggested is the sort of attitudes or temperaments that we're seeing now, you could also say were in place during the Pax Romana, you know, at the end of a certain period of time in Roman history. We can go back to epics in history and see the sort of spirit that is rising now, in this case as a result of the internet, but at other times as a result of other changing technological innovations or sort of historical events that caused a sea change in thinking towards culture. And so I'm very comfortable with seeing hints of metamodernism, or if you will, notes of metamodernism in thinkers going back hundreds and hundreds of years. I just think we identify it now as being, first of all, the dominant cultural philosophy of our time, and then number two, in our case, in our time, particularly connected to the medium of the internet, which serves as sort of the central metaphor in many respects for what metamodernism is, which is this combination of opposites, combinations of opposing poles, somehow in a central space serve to empower the creation of new phenomena, integral to how we live today, even though we can see that they're taken from very disparate influences. So remixing, for instance, in music, sort of metamodern inclination, but by the same token, so is slow television. I don't know if you guys have heard about slow TV. It's very popular in Scandinavia, but basically they put a video camera on the front of a train, broadcast that as a television program, and people just watch it for hours. Slow TV is an example of a metamodern phenomenon. On some level, we understand that what we're doing is dangerous and it's voyeuristic, and it is something to help feel a little bit cynical about doing because it is in a certain respect, but at the same time, it's peaceful. At the same time, it's freeing. Have some control over the pace of the art that we're creating or the art that we're consuming. So slow poetry and slow television are every bit as much metamodern as is a frenetic remixing.
Yeah, it's making me think of Google Earth or something like The Truman Show even, where not much is going on, but there's this consistency and you can tune in, and it is definitely voyeuristic because you're watching a human life unfold. But it made me also kind of think about slow cinema. Bellatar, he did a film called The Turin Horse, which is one of my favorite films the last few years, but he did another film called Satan Tango a few years ago that's 7.5 hours and not much really happens. And it's Yeah, it seems to kind of have a very, it's not a, you don't go in there for a cheap thrill and for the dopamine rush that you get if you're watching a Vin Diesel movie or something like that, right? You go in there and it's much more a sort of meditative, calming experience rather than anything else.
I think it's also about the juxtaposition of art and life. I don't know if you've seen the Leo Carax movie, Holy Motors, for instance. Mm-hmm. The movie Holy Motors is very much about not deconstructing moment to moment exactly what's happening or why it's happening in that particular film, but sort of existing in that state of generative ambiguity. You begin to see that there's a fluidity to experience, a fluidity that we might also associate with how we experience a performance by Reggie Watts when he's moving between genres, he's moving between modes of expression, he's moving between tonalities seamlessly. If you've ever watched Reggie Watts, it's a seamless transition where it would be very difficult to deconstruct it into its parts. But we really would see it as, again, a centralizing in a space between all opposing poles of a new form of expression is inspiring and in some way creates a new sort of meta-narrative, even if we can see some of its seams.
Yes, and this is probably a good time to get away from the weeds, which has been great, and I feel like I have a better understanding of a lot of things now to talking about this, into that the article you wrote about the alt-right, the other alt-right, and the emerging alt-left. I've had a bit of difficulty. I think you're talking about art and newer television shows. I think of Atlanta as being a really great example of a lot of the things you've talked about. But when I get into politics, I find it a little bit more difficult to situate myself with alt-modernism, with metamodernism. So I'm hoping we can kind of clear some of this stuff up a little bit. What are these two alt-rights, and how do you think that metamodernism helps us distinguish between one and the other?
I posited that the alt-right could be, given what we've been talking about, I suppose it's appropriate, deconstructed into two different wings. Increasingly, I wonder if it isn't three. Changes, you know, what I've written, but also it might explain the question that you're asking a little bit better. So one of the elements within the alt-right is certainly fueled by and ethnic and religious animus. So hatred of the other, non-white, non-Christian, immigrant communities, with the idea that that's a component of the alt-right. And it undoubtedly is. I don't even think the alt-right would deny that that's an element of that term and of that movement. I also wrote in the article that you're talking about that there is an element of the alt-right as typified on 4chan. Granted, in many instances, these are straight white males of a certain age who are using 4chan as a way to express their action with all extant institutions. And so often they will troll or punk that are most vulnerable, whatever institution or whatever group seems most vulnerable to having their this exposed. Right now, there's a feeling on 4chan that the left, particularly the new progressive left, what we associate at least with the, rightly or wrongly with the term political correctness, that those who are on that end of the political spectrum and in that particular sector of the progressive movement are particularly open to being ridiculed for their self-righteousness. See, again, I'm just stating the view of this wing of the alt-right. And so often they will very aggressive actions toward this sector of the American political community, as they would say, for the lulz, meaning for the laughs, or simply as a way of proving a point that satisfies them in some way. Now, having said that, I think that there's an element to that sort of behavior when it becomes pathological that is nihilistic. Fundamentally, you are simply looking to create pleasure for yourself, a sort of anarchy or sort of chaos that you create, a sort of deconstruction or aggression toward who seems to be impeding your progress towards self-fulfillment emotionally. But the form of self-fulfillment imagined, I would say, is fairly stunted and nominal. Now, those were the two sectors I talked about in my article. I think that there might be a third one, and this would be the most metamodern, really the metamodern expression of the alt-right, if there is one. And that would be those who are seeking a completely new system of the two parties. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean creating a negotiation between the Democrats and the Republicans. We're not talking about simply moderate American politics here. where there's simply log rolling between moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans. We're talking about those who are, in a generative and hopeful and optimistic way, imagining that a certain amount of deconstruction and critique of both the left and the right to an entirely new way of formulating our politics. Now, that's been fully articulated yet. Do we have a political figure who's the perfect expression of metamodernism? There are elements that we would call metamodern, though, as I like to say, I think he only gets there through sociopathy, meaning he gets there because he's a sociopath, in my view, not because he's a philosopher. But there are certain manifestations of his sincere and cynical persona that we might call metamodern. This is separating it from the policy, but simply the persona. Modern, but again, I think he comes to it because he's a troubled person and not because he has philosophized his way to a new politics.
Yeah, well, I think we can all agree with the assessment of sociopathy there. But it's interesting that you added that third category. One of the things that I've engaged in, or I should say some of the people with whom I've engaged online, particularly on Twitter over the last few months, I think fit into that last category. They're individuals that are self-defined as alt-right, but they're critical of Spencer. They're critical of that, what's his name, Paul Joseph or Joseph Paul, the British
Watson.
Dude. Yeah, that guy.
Watson.
The angry guy, the really angry British guy. they're critical of him, critical of Bannon, critical of Cernovich, and they derive a lot of their – these individuals. Now, they're younger. They're young academic types, white,
right,
seemingly middle class. They are very interested in anime in Japan, very interested in Oswald Spengler and German romanticism, cultural pessimism, the decline of the West. A lot of these texts that came around the turn of the 20th century that were very pessimistic that ultimately led to the rise of fascism. So it's interesting to see why people sort of – want to fit these young guys into that category of being nationalists with the capital N, you know, in the patch in the bad way. But they don't see themselves that way. They actually sort of shun that sort of tropey white nationalism that is often, I guess, accredited to Spencer and various other figures. And I think they might fit within that third category.
I think it's possible, though I think the danger is that there is a sort of neo-modernist contingent that is sometimes confused with metamodernists. For instance, those who wish to turn to the hegemony of meta-narratives, simply a different meta-narrative than we've previously seen before, but would nevertheless subjugate all of us to a fairly sort of monolithic meta-narrative, those would be neo-modernistic principles and tendencies. Let me give you an example of what might be a metamodern perspective on a political topic, a particularly controversial topic, and that would be white privilege. The dialectical view of white privilege, so the postmodern and we might say post-structuralist view of the concept of white privilege, is that white privilege is part of a racial patriarchy, pole on a polar spectrum that is dialectical, meaning white privilege pushes against and human rights of disadvantaged minority groups in the United States. And so the two push against each other, white privilege pushes against its opposite, and one is going to emerge victorious over the other under the dialectical view. Those who therefore fight against white privilege feel that they are fighting for the eradication. Now let me give you the metamodern view, and some people listening might find this in concert with their own views. Take all of the bundle of invisible rights that make up what is often called the backpack of rights. In the initial article about white privilege, it was referred to as an invisible backpack. If you unpack all of the rights that we associate with white privilege and you look at each one of them, we can see each one of them as something that any one of us would naturally want to have applied to us, meaning their totality. What the term white privilege denotes is simply treating other people as well as you can possibly. From that standpoint, imagine if someone were to say to you that white privilege should be human privilege, that not that white privilege needs to be destroyed, but that everyone of all races, religions, immigrant status, disability status, sexual identity status, all persons need to enjoy the rights that we associated with white privilege. From that standpoint, we're not trying to destroy white privilege. We're trying to redefine it as human privilege and expand it dramatically to all persons in the United States. That would be one way to, in a metamodern viewpoint and with a metamodern attitude and temperament, approach a controversial topic. What you say is that it's not a dialectical issue. It's not about destroying something. It's actually about expanding it to cover everyone. I think that a lot of people who are currently threatened by the conversation over white privilege, themselves differently situated toward the conversation, if people simply said, look, we just want what you have also. We don't want to take anything away from you. We want everyone to enjoy what you enjoy. That's a less confrontational and a more collaborative approach towards creating social justice in the United States. I don't know what you guys think about that, but that's a theory, right? Now, it's a still developing theory, but it's an example of a theory that might develop under a metamodern philosophical regime as compared to a dialectical post-structuralist regime.
So we'll ask the question everyone's thinking. Does that mean Bernie's the first metamodern politician?
So, and I'm so nervous because I know we get so into the weeds here, and I'll, for a second, I might go a little bit further, but there are three schools of thought cultural generally. One is what's called aesthetic liberal, and that's often associated with, let's say, the Hillary Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, a sort of sense that it's okay for us to have a common American culture so long as it's not low culture, but it's high culture. Then there's a corporate liberal attitude, which says that American culture is whatever American consumers want it to be. And then there is the radical socialist view of culture, which basically looks at culture primarily through the lens of economics and says that it's okay for us to have a common culture if economic justice and civil and human rights are shared by all people. I think sometimes people on the right wrongly think that Bernie Sanders' radical view of American culture is somehow dialectical, is somehow an attack. Wrong. The Sanders view, and this is why Sanders did appeal to many people who ultimately voted for Donald Trump, the Sanders appeal was of completely renegotiating the political contract, and not in a way that is a contest of two sides beating each other into oblivion, but is an attempt to lift all people without, and I emphasize this, without taking away any of the rights or privileges or pleasures, frankly, that all of us enjoy living in American culture.
Yeah, I think one of the helpful things about that analysis, and that makes a lot of sense to me, is you look at the effects of the Bernie and Hillary primary season. A lot of the centrist and liberal Democrat response to the Sanders movement was a very, almost an aesthetic sense of being repelled. It wasn't just on the merits of the ideas so much as just, this is a different thing that looks ugly to us for various reasons. The Bernie Bros thing being just one example of that. And so I think that this whole take really helps make sense in my mind why that aesthetic difference was so apparent. And it's still apparent. I mean, there's a split amongst seeming liberals in the United States over what seems like this issue.
Yeah, you know, the aesthetic liberal perception of American culture tends to see what they would call low culture as unruly and brutalistic threat to established institutions. And I think you're exactly right that they saw Bernie Sanders as sort of an icon of that particular sort of danger. His hair was unruly, or that he would shout a lot, was associated with a sort of brutalism or unruliness that was a danger, which I absolutely, as a Bernie Sanders supporter, which I was and which I am, see as a complete misreading of both the man and his movement.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, we're going pretty long here, but if we can just kind of, because I mean, I don't know if I can. I'd love to have you on again, and we can talk more about other stuff in future episodes. But you talk a lot about art, and you talk a lot about metamodern practice. And since we're talking about aesthetics right now, is there a sense in which political aesthetics, metamodern political aesthetics, is useful in the present historical moment to try to create sort of better positive visions of virtue, justice, that socialist vision of human society that you were talking about? And if so, what does it sort of look like in just broad strokes?
Well, I think the answer is absolutely. And one of the big elements of that is what we've been discussing, is that in order to instrumentalize any progressive political principles, you need to have some belief in meta-narrative. It doesn't have to be an unyielding absolute belief in a certain truth that only you possess, but it does have to be a willingness to have what we might call a guiding star. And that guiding star requires often a meta-narrative to move toward it, even if it's one that you're convinced is a perfect narrative, but it still sort of propels you forward toward what you know are the shared goals of your group. I think a few phenomena that we sometimes call metamodern include bad commercials or ambiguously bad YouTube videos where you can't tell if the person was trying to be bad or not, or commercials which are bad but actually make you want to buy the product because the commercial tells you not to buy the product and tells you that the product is bad. You know, these are the sorts of paradoxes we're talking about with metamodernism. So how does that apply to politics? We can imagine an American politician who was metamodern, who essentially is tarnished, sometimes a little bit sort of deliberately, what's the word that I'm looking for? I don't want to say sloppy, but unpolished in some way, creating therefore both a sense of reflexivity and an awareness of one's own inability to, in a polished way, present one's principles, but also the appealing DIY themselves element that I think a lot of us would respond to in politics right now. You know, one of the most well-known metamodern writers right now is Karl Ove Knausgård, a Scandinavian memoirist, life, which is basically just a description of his day-to-day experience in excruciating detail. And people say, and I agree with them, that it's a page-turner. Even though it's just him eating breakfast, it actually is a gripping read. Politician who is a gripping watch, but not a gripping watch because of the sort of dark sociopathological danger that I do think is posed and in a certain sense epitomized by Donald Trump. That sort of manic yet also authentic energy that clearly is a deconstruction of contemporary politics, but is also an earnest expression of who the person is. Lives. I think we want a politician who can speak through and about Americans' daily lives in a way that is self-aware, but is also authentic and earnest and inspiring and hopeful. And so I think when we get a politician like that, it will lead to a movement. It'll lead to a movement of young people also, not just white young people, but young people who are from marginalized groups who have not been listened to by our politicians for many decades. People will give large amounts of, you know, or small, a large number of people will give small amounts of money. I mean, all the things that we saw with the Sanders campaign are what you'd expect to come from a campaign run by a generally left of center metamodern politician. And so I guess the answer to your question in a roundabout way is if you're looking for a framework, it was Bernie Sanders. There's an echo of it in Donald Trump, though, as I mentioned, that comes to us via other means than the philosophical. Bernie Sanders would probably be the best example.
Yeah, I like the idea that this would help explain why Bernie had the effective response that he had, especially with young people, and that this idea of feeling and the way Bernie makes you feel, not in the kind of, evangelical churchy sense of you have, the spirit comes into your heart and you feel a certain way, but that he certainly makes you respond in a very different way than kind of roboticized typical politicians like a Clinton do. And the reason that nobody expected an old Jewish guy from Vermont to have such a impact on young people, and it has everything to do with this, and not because he was inherently cool or listen to the same music that the kids listen to or some other trope like that.
Well, and that's exactly it. I think that the neoliberal view would be let's construct a candidate who the kids will like because he reflects, you know, where they're at and he talks about Snapchat or whatever, something stupid like that. Bernie Sanders was popular precisely because of the hair that he wore, because of the fact that you're not actually supposed to shout that much when you're a politician. I mean, everything he did, if you were deliberately trying to be a bad politician, and yet that's who he really was. that he was aware that he was a non-typical politician. And so what you're responding to is both the earnestness and the reflexivity of someone who clearly reflect young America, but in his spirit, in his values, very much does reflect where I think many young Americans are at right now.
Yeah, my favorite anecdote is of Bernie meeting Killer Mike and having to ask him whether or not he's actually killed anybody.
Exactly, right? But here's the thing, that didn't turn people off. And there's a reason why it didn't turn people off. There's a reason why Bernie supporters thought that was adorable. 20 years ago, that would have been devastating. It would have suggested that a politician was out of touch and therefore couldn't represent the constituency he was trying to speak to. I think it's a sign that we're in the metamodern era that Bernie Sanders can ask Killer Mike if he's killed anyone, and it doesn't cause young people to turn away from him. And to be clear, I don't think it caused young fans or listeners to Killer Mike to turn away from Bernie Sanders either. It was just seen as that's who Bernie actually is. And it's funny and it's a little bit schlocky, but it's also who he is, and people responded to it.
Which tells you why people who voted for Bernie would have gone for Trump over Clinton, just in terms of that aesthetic and structure of feeling.
Yes, and I think the Clintons never understood that. I mean, they did not understand that we have moved beyond a dialectical political sphere. In the dialectical political sphere, if you're left of center, you vote for Clinton because you vote either blue or red, and you're going to choose blue over red. And that's what the Clintons, I think, expected would happen. If you realize that we're in a non-dialectical, in fact, dialogic, metamodern political sphere, you understand that you have to run a candidate who actually embodies the values and the sort of first principles and some of the meta-narrative that youth culture is developing in America today, partly because of the internet, partly socioeconomic and cultural reasons. And the Democrats don't understand that. Let's be very clear. They have no idea that this is the case. If you look at the candidates they're considering running in 4 years, understanding of why they lost the last election, and I do not currently see a candidate who fits sort of Bernie's profile, except Bernie himself. I'm not saying that a candidate won't arise, but I am saying that we're early enough in this sort of political conversation that the three of us are having right now, that I don't know that we'll even see in 4 years this conversation reflected in the slate of candidates. Having said that, if it's not reflected pretty soon, both the Democratic and the Republican parties will collapse. They will splinter into multiple parties. If the people in those two parties don't understand pretty quickly that there's been what we call a paradigm shift, is simply not politics before the internet age. It's not politics of the post-structuralist period. It's something entirely different. If they don't get that, I don't know that we're going to have two parties 20 years from now. I think we might have four, five, six parties.
Hmm. Have you read the book Inventing the Future by Nick Cernik and Alex Williams?
No.
So it's a book that was published by Verso Books in the end of 2015, beginning of 2016. It's called Inventing the Future. The subtitle is Post-Capitalism in a World Without Work. And I'm actually in the middle of adapting it into a documentary right now. And they talk about things that I think you would really enjoy. And the reason I ask is because one of the things that they talk about is like a hyperstitional future, which is this idea of positing this utopic vision of the future that affects you in the present to kind of then motivate you to then realize that. But then that hyperstitional vision itself is malleable and transformable and sensitive to the material conditions. And so it's constantly transforming and the collective subject is always being transformed and recreated, et cetera, et cetera. And it's this endless process. And it's just so interesting because I'd never heard this term, metamodern, before. And yet it does seem to echo in so much of the, I guess we'll say, political theory that I'm attracted to, at least. And so I find this really exciting. And so, I mean, I'm so thankful that you came on and that you chatted with us. We have to have you on again and we can talk more about, cause you are also, a pretty avid journalist as well. So we can talk about some of your, more journalistic political musings maybe in the future. But, Troy, is there anything you want to say in conclusion, wrapping up, anything else you want to ask?
No, I just want to thank Seth for coming on, and it's been an interesting discussion. I think we've got a lot more to talk about in the future, which is a good way to end a discussion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Austin, if I can, just because you just said something that was so great to me, you know, the first metamodernist I ever met, though he didn't identify himself at the time, was someone who said to me, live in the present, want to see come to pass, has already happened. And what you just described from the book, Reinventing the Future, sounds like about it, seemed very similar to that sort of philosophy, the modern philosophy. So I'll check out the book. It sounds great. And I'm really glad I was able to talk to you guys.
Absolutely. Our pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks again.
Thanks, guys.
All right, so thanks again to Seth for coming on. That was a great discussion and definitely more serious than I think we ever get. Mm. But good nonetheless. Our next segment is The Sticky Leaves, which is where one of us talks about whatever is giving us meaning in a meaningless universe. And Austin, you're not allowed to say metamodernism, even though you're stoked on it right now. So do you have something else to give us?
Nope. sort of, but it is actually related. And I did sort of talk about it at the end of the segment. And the reason that I'm going to be talking about this is because the only thing that I have been doing besides hanging out with Kira is working on this fucking documentary. And I say that with I don't know why I use the expletive, because I'm having the time of my life. But I am currently running on 7 hours of sleep over the last 2 days because I got about 4 hours the night before, 3 hours last night, and I'm still kind of jacked. I have a lot of energy because this project has really taken off over the last month, and so there's just a lot of work to be done. Is basically what it is. But my Sticky Leaves is really not about the project so much as it is about the collaboration, which is something that I think is absolutely fantastic. And that's my Sticky Leaves, is that there is something wonderful about being able to work in a collaborative artistic environment with individuals where you just sort of slot together. And you may disagree on certain things, you know. The director is this brilliant young director. His first debut feature played at TIFF, Toronto International Film Festival, and Locarno, and then the New York Film Festival and various other places. It's called 8888, and it's this experimental avant-garde documentary. It's not even a documentary. It's sort of a documentary, but it's a sort of cinematic documentation of poverty and youth culture and things like that. But he is younger than I am, and he's more committed to the avant-garde spirit than I am. I worked in Hollywood, and I used to work for a fucking production company that did online brand marketing for various online outlets. And I've done other things in, like, you know, developing TV shows and things like that. And it's all about fucking celebrities, and you got to get this person to, you know, be your spokesperson, or you're not going to get financing. And so there's a difference there, but at the same time, there's also a spirit that's a commonality. And it's just been really wonderful to, I guess, challenge myself, and at the same time, hopefully challenge the other members of the team, the production team on the other side in Toronto that are working on this. They're called Quantity, or QTY. And Isaiah Medina. And then, of course, we have the writers, Nick Cernick and Alex Williams, who are in England. And they wrote the book from which we are adapting this documentary. And then, of course, there's the publishing company. And it's just right now, it's been a really nice ride. And I know that the artistic filmmaking process isn't always this smooth, because I have been in some shit storms before with developing other projects. And it is just so refreshing to be in a collaborative artistic environment where people are excited to wake up, or excited to not sleep, because they want to tell you about this new thing that they've done, or this new idea that they have, or this new concept that they think might fit for distribution. And so lovely. And I think that's really just what I want to say. I mean, I don't know if there's anything that I can bequeath to any listeners, except to say that if you can collaborate and get involved in artistic endeavors, whether it's political or social, or more explicitly, I guess, what we would think about when we use the word art, I would just encourage you to try to find people that will maximize your potency, people that you can actually connect with. And I don't mean that in the cheesy, like, oh, I really connected with her, man. But I mean in the sense that your strengths and their strengths pragmatically come together to create this new machine of productivity. And it's just been a wonderful experience. So I don't know, man. I'm flying high right now, even though Kira's like, dude, you need to sleep. And I'm like, babe, I can't sleep. I got work to do, but I got stuff to do. So, but yeah, well, it's been great.
I agree with everything you said, and I will take issue though with one claim that you made.
Oh no.
That's the idea that you're flying high, that you're juiced because of the collaboration, even though you're really tired. Mm-hmm. I think you're juiced because you're Austin.
Yeah.
I think if the world were ending and you were this tired, you would still find ways to get juiced. Because you'd be like, yeah, I got 12 hours left before the world ends. I'm going to go out and live it up, man. I'm going to get every experience possible. It's going to be so amazing. And you would still do it.
You know, it's funny you say that. Yeah. I was just walking back to my house this morning, and I was having this thought. I don't really believe anything. And I was like, do people actually believe things? Believe in things. Like, to me, I just kind of like try things, you know? I don't know if I actually believe, and I mean that with like a capital B. Like, I believe things with a little b, but do I really believe things with a capital B? I don't know, man. I think I just like, I'm like a fat kid in a candy store that just wants to taste all the candy. And that's just kind of the way I go through life. I'm just tasting all the candy, man. Just give me the candy. Just let me keep tasting.
Here's the major difference between me and you. Epistemological crisis. When you hear that, you're like, opportunity. When I hear that, I'm like, the death of everything.
Yeah, dude. I'm still in my epistemological crisis that initiated when I was 22 years old, and I'm riding that wave, brother. I used to tell my students this. I'd be like, you know, you got to fall in love with process. And I think I really do. I do love process. And so I think that's – and I'm going to go back now. I'm going to whip this around. That's the word I'm looking for. I'm going to whip this around here. But I think that's one of the things I'm loving about this artistic endeavor is that it is this sort of open-ended experimentation that is very processual. And I'm just really enjoying it. So that's my sticky leaves this week. Collaborate and create. And even if you don't think you're creating shit, I believe that even if it's getting involved with a charity or serving at your Anabaptist Sunday meal, or if it's, you know, being involved in politics, that's all creative. And I don't know. I think we just have to find the points of connection that we can make to maximize our potency in those creative spheres. And yeah, that's my sticky leads this week, brother.
Yep. All right, so our next segment here is a bullshitting segment, where we talk about something that either we know nothing about or that literally doesn't matter for anything. And I think the this week's bullshitting segment is mostly the latter, because we're going to talk about daylight savings, which just happened on Sunday. It was yesterday for us recording this, but it'll be a few days prior when you're listening out there. And you over in Europe haven't quite had yours yet, right?
No, in Ireland, it's March 29th is when our daylight savings hits. So, yeah. So to me, it really doesn't matter because it doesn't even exist in my world right now.
Yeah, no. For me, it's Monday morning. It's Monday afternoon. We're recording this, and Monday morning I have an 8 o'clock class, which was
really a 7 o'clock
class. Which was I told my students when we started out, this is literally the worst time to have a class you could ever have.
Hey, I only have one thing to say about time changes. You ready? We're not fucking farmers anymore, man. We don't need that shit. Even when farmers are farmers, technology overcomes that shit. We don't need daylight savings. We don't need fallback. We don't need leap forward. We don't need that shit. We're good. Let's just do like Arizona does and just ignore it.
Okay, you ready for my hot take then?
Yeah, go.
Okay. I'm going to channel Nietzsche and say we need this speed bump. Even though we have the technological capacity to easily surmount it and to make life easier for everybody, we need this speed bump so we feel like we're conquering something twice a year on this schedule.
We're literally conquering the Earth's rotation and revolution around the sun. Is that what we're doing?
Yeah. In fact, I think we should accelerate it every day.
It should be a time change.
Every day, and it's totally random. You'll wake up one day, you'll look at your phone, it'll say now it's 12 p.m. when it normally would be 6 a.m. And then tomorrow, it'll go back 24 hours and you'll repeat the day again, all over again. Every day. But what is the meta-moderns call it? Generative ambiguity?
Mm-hmm.
Time should be generatively ambiguous. We have no idea what it's going to be at any point until it happens.
That's a short film.
I would appreciate a world that is like that. Because, you know, we always have this like a 1984, you know, dystopian situations where the government's just oppressive and trying to control everything. And you have so many different versions of that, from like Hunger Games to whatever else. Why can't we just have a ridiculous government? I just want a government that no one ascribes any malfeasance towards, no nefarious sort of tendencies, not captured by corporations or anything like that, but just totally Dr. Seuss style ridiculous. And it's difficult to bear. It's a burden. It's not like a happy ambiguity like a Dr. Seuss, but a difficult one. But everyone just understands, well, this is just, I guess, everything's ridiculous.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about it? That would be great.
I kind of want to see that. I'm kind of down for that.
We should make a short film where that actually happens, and we have to try to figure out how to live that way.
The problem is, we would have to do that under the conditions that you just mentioned, where there isn't some sort of intention on the part of the controllers of time, because there would be, right? There'd be some sort of like master plan, like this is how they control the masses. But no, what if it was just simply because they want to experiment with human beings? Like it's some scientists or some philosophers that basically just wanted to explore human psychological capacities through the experimentation of time manipulation. And so this is what they do.
Even go further and ascribe no motive to it. It's just the way the world is. And so we have to figure out how to live in it.
Oh. Well, it would be, right? Over generations. It would just become habitual.
Yeah, but if it's truly random.
Or do you not even want to acknowledge that? You don't even want to acknowledge that at all. Like this is just, it just is.
It just is. I just want to experiment with how do you live in worlds that are completely different than ours.
Yeah.
So the daylight savings is a promise. That's my point. It's a gift.
It's a gift and it's a promise for what?
I don't know. Cool shit?
Good enough for me.
Yeah, whatever. I'm done thinking about this. This is stupid.
All right. Well, I lose an hour of sleep in approximately – what's the date today?
Is it the 14th? 13th? We're recording this on the 13th.
And so in like 2 weeks here. I lose my hour of sleep, so maybe I'll be grumpy about that, or maybe I'll feel like I've overcome something at that point. But right now, it doesn't even matter to me.
If you're an Uber, I didn't even know it existed.
But here's the thing: even with the age of contemporary cell phones, if they didn't tell us that it was daylight savings, would anybody really know? If all of our clocks were just sort of synced up to automatically shift at 2 o'clock or at midnight, unless you were paying attention to your clock at that time, if you were asleep, you wouldn't really know, right? It would just happen. And so it kind of would have that effect. And I think a lot of times it does have that effect that you're kind of talking about anyway. Because like when you messaged me and were like, yo, it was daylight savings, I looked at my clock and I was like, is it? Like I had to Google what is the time in Los Angeles right now so that I could see what that – because I wouldn't have known, because the only clock I ever use is on my phone. And it just changes automatically. We're almost there, dude.
We're getting there.
We're getting there, brother. All right. Fuck this. Moving on. Michael, what's going on this week in hip hop?
Hip hop?
Hey, what's up? It's This Week in Hip Hop with Michael Burns on the Owls of Dawn podcast. Hope everyone's doing well. If you hear nature sounds in the background, it's because it's a nice day where I live, and where I live in England is normally shitty, so fucking deal with it. Decent week in the world of the hip hop music, so let's talk about it. The most important track that came out since we've last spoken, Freddie Gibbs. Put out a new track. It's getting us ready for a new full-length project. The track is called Crushed Glass. Damn, it's good. So, I mean, if you need to, just stop listening now. Go listen to that 8 times. Punch a brick wall. Come back, finish it. I would understand. But really good song. Insanely dope beat. It has a trap snares, good sample, R&B hook. And Gibbs is intense on this song. And he speaks directly on the rape case that had him locked up in Europe last year. Talks about being in jail in Austria and going through all of that. So it's really intense, really personal, but has that Freddie Gibbs edge to it. So listen to that immediately. Album that came out this week. Something that I'd mentioned on the podcast before, something I've been looking forward to. Your Old Droog came out with his second record. It's called Pax. Don't know much about Your Old Droog. He's a Ukrainian-American rapper from Brooklyn. Came out a few years ago, and there was some mystery initially. People actually thought that on his first tracks that it was a secret Nas project. And I know what you're thinking. A Ukrainian guy sounds like Nas. Kind of does. But he's a really good traditional East Coast rapper. Has a nice edge on him. The album is, in general, really good. Features from Danny Brown, Chris Crack, Wiki, Edon, Heems, and comedian Anthony Jeselnik. Jeselnik has these interludes on the album. I'm not sure if they need to be there. And I don't know if Anthony Jeselnik is the most hip-hop option when it comes to comedy. But whatever, do you. Who am I to judge? A production from Drew himself, 88 Keys, Alchemist, a few others. So you get it. Traditional East Coast, dusty, gritty style of production. Overall, really, really good project. Mostly hits, a few misses, but from start to finish, it really nails being a contemporary East Coast record. When I say contemporary, I mean this isn't some nostalgic fan service thing where a young dude from Brooklyn tries to sound like he's making a record in 96. It's contemporary. It has some flair on it, has an edge on it. The tracks that really stood out to me, Grandma's Hips featuring Danny Brown. I know it's shocking that I would love a track featuring Yurel Droog and Danny Brown. That one's really good. Help featuring Edon and Wiki. Man, I think Wiki kind of steals the show here. If you don't know who Wiki is, he is a young New York rapper. He was in the group Rat King. And this track, Help, is that classic three dudes rapping their asses off over an urgent beat track, with the chorus being kind of like a catch your breath moment before someone comes back in and continues to rap their ass off. Another track called You Can Do It, in parentheses, Give Up. Very confusing message, Yurel Droog. I don't know which one it is. But that one was really great. The production's really awesome on it. It has a really chill kind of like slow beat piano sample. It's from some 70s track that you'll probably all know because you're smarter than me. But that one was really great. But overall, good record. A couple songs that I don't know if they're problematic, but just didn't really do it for me. So the record opens with the song GKAC, which stands for Gotta Kill a Cop. And it's a song that tells the story about a guy who's listening to voices in his head, and the voices tell him that he's got to kill a cop. And it's the story of him doing that. Now, I get it. It's a storytelling song. It's intense. It's controversial. But I don't know. I don't know if this one really works. And I'm not saying that in some sort of Blue Lives Matter way. Believe me. But it comes across a little weird. And I'm curious to see if this leads to any controversy. Probably not. That song, good song though. The song that I really just didn't like conceptually is a song on the record called White Rappers, in parentheses, A Good Guest. Why do I find this problematic? Well, I'll tell you. I think there's something different between being a white rapper and a rapper that is a white person, right? And calling that out on a song and making a big deal out of it, it just seems kind of corny. Like the chorus of the song is something like, you know, it's not the color of your skin. It's about if an MC goes in. And it's just like, we get it, man. Like, I don't know. I've never heard tracks from people like, I don't know, Evidence or LP or Action Bronson where they are, you know, discussing their own status as white rappers. They're just dudes that are white that rap really well. It's kind of like the act like you've been there before principle, a personal life motto. But either way, I don't know. That one just didn't do it for me. And like, what's the point of pointing at yourself and saying, I'm a white rapper, but it doesn't matter because I'm really good. Just be really good and no one will care, right? You don't want to have a repetition of that thing that our dude Macklemore did, not our dude, when he ethered himself on that White Privilege song, that kind of self-serving, I'm one of the good white guys tracks, because we haven't heard from him since that. But that said, overall, you're all Droog. Packs, really good record. Listen to it. Last thing I'll mention is so Griselda, the label that's basically West Side Gunn and Conway, got picked up by Shady Records, which is run by Mr. Eminem, and they just re-released one of West Side Gunn's projects. Big fan of him on this podcast. And they're calling it Hitler on steroids. So it's basically some tracks from his Hitler mixtapes. I know I'm saying the word Hitler, feels awkward, with some new stuff as well. Two things. Great that Gunn and Conway been picked up by Shady. Hopefully their music is going to have a bigger audience right now. Also, if you haven't heard their stuff before, this is a great way to get into West Side Gunn. The mixtape, once again, Hitler on Steroids. It's free to download. A lot of tracks that you would have heard before if you've been on the West Side Gunn train. But then some new ones as well. One of the new ones, 100,000 Machine Guns featuring Royce the 5'9". It's really good. It's so good that we're going to play it right now and listen to it as we fade off into the night. This has been This Week in Hip Hop with me, Michael Burns, on this, the Alta Dawn podcast. Thank you for listening. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, I'm at Mick O'Broin. If you don't want to hit me up, that's fine too. I don't need you. Have a great week. Listen to good music. Don't do bad shit. Bye. Went to sleep, drink a million bricks. Woke up like Caldwell, like real nigga shit. Shady dress dropped off the bag. Now I'm about to go flip the shit. So Poppy, I'll be right back. Took the ones to Captain Island. Took the ones to Captain Island.
All right, then. Thank you for that, Michael. Austin, do you feel uncomfortable saying Hitler?
I mean, not really, to be honest. Not really. Although I did hear a funny experiment. I was talking to a group of kids yesterday in a high school, or a secondary school, I guess they would call it. And in a previous discussion they had, this was a philosophy society, and in a previous discussion they had, they were talking about whether or not you can separate art from the artist. And the person who was talking was showing a couple of Hitler's paintings, and the students were like, oh, those are really good paintings. Those are really good paintings. And then he was like, those are Adolf Hitler's paintings. And then all the kids were like, oh, no. So.
In Europe, do they show Bush's paintings next?
Oh, does he have them?
You didn't know he was a painter?
No, he was not.
George Bush. Oh, yeah, that's the whole thing, dude.
I did.
He's painting a lot of portraits or something of fallen soldiers.
Like presently or historically he has?
From the wars he perpetrated.
From the wars he perpetrated. Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's his way of sort of dealing with it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean.
All sins forgiven.
Catharsis, right?
Yeah, whatever gets you through the day, man.
I guess. Maybe he should listen to some Freddie Gibbs and that'll help him get over it.
Yeah, I was digging. I definitely dug his stuff with Madlib back in the day. I'm wondering if I like this new stuff as much. Mm. Did you listen to that that Year Old Droog?
I haven't checked it out yet.
Tracks that Michael recommended?
No. Good?
Oh, I had no idea who this guy was, but I listened to that song Help, and I was digging it, and then some like samples of old Frank Zappa albums from the 70s started popping up in the song.
Oh, shit.
I couldn't believe it, man. I've never heard Frank Zappa sampled in a hip-hop song.
Sounds like something awesome. Danny Brown would do, right?
Yeah, it was on the song that Danny Brown was on.
Oh, it wasn't? Okay. Yeah.
Is in the spirit for sure.
Yeah. Right on. Sounds good. So what else is going on? Anything new and exciting this week, or are we closing things out?
I think we're closing things out.
Sounds good to me. Thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Owls at Dawn. Shout out to all of those motherfuckers who said what up on Instagram and Twitter. Keep feeding us lines, letting us know what you think. If you have any recommendations for topics you would like us to BS about, please don't hesitate to reach out. You can hit us at owls_at_dawn at both Twitter and Instagram. And I think there's an email address, right, Troy?
Yeah, owls@dawnpodcast@gmail.com.
Sounds good. Shoot us a line if you want. And other than that...
Oh, I just wanted to say real quick, when Austin a minute ago was talking about being at a high school with a bunch of 14-year-olds, he was not doing the Matthew McConaughey high school girls, you know, I keep getting older, they keep staying the same age.
Definitely not.
Thing?
No.
All right. No, yeah, but that wasn't what you were doing.
No.
So you didn't put a lot of context there. So you just felt like you're hanging out with high school.
I was invited to speak at a secondary school for your information. See, now this is how rumors get started, Troy.
Yeah, I mean, I start them. About
I start them.
This is not in doubt.
Thanks, dude.
All right, on that note, Dasa Dani, America.